From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. We'll update you on wolf and moose since the National Park Service decided to put more wolves on Isle Royale.
Most scientists have an understanding that a healthy ecosystem is one where you have large ungulates and large predators. That's an important part of, especially a place like Isle Royale.
Then we hear from the Republican candidate running against incumbent member of Congress, Debbie Dingell. It's his second time running, and he believes, given his performance last time, he can win this year.
We estimate about 35% of those votes came from independents and Democrats, so we're pretty happy with those results, but there was more work to be done. And so we're here doing it.
We get an update about today's U.S. Senate race debate, the second debate in 2 days. Then we'll hear about an online news service that's trying to serve Flint where the legacy media do not.
Local coverage, like Flint Beat, is important to empower a community and to inform and to hold government accountable.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. The Democratic and Republican candidates for U.S. Senate squared off again today. Incumbent Debbie Stabenow and challenger John James held a debate in Grand Rapids last night and a second one in Detroit today. Chad Livengood with Crain's Detroit was at today's Detroit Economic Club meeting, which hosted the debate. In fact, you were on the panel of journalists, right? So last night's debate covered health care, Social Security, trade, a border wall with Mexico, and President Trump. It was a little testy at times. How would you describe today's debate?
Well, today they did engage more. They did get back in some back and forth. Each of them used their allotted time to make a couple of rebuttals. And it was a better, free-flowing exchange than that televised debate in Grand Rapids last night. But it was, you know, still sort of restrained to a one-hour format at a lunchtime meeting of the Detroit Economic Club. There were 700 people in attendance, so it was a packed house at the Motor City Casino. But, you know, they had a pretty good back and forth with each other on all those different issues and more.
Well, let's talk about some of their positions. Where did they differ most strongly?
You know, it was a lot about approach on health care issues. John James continued to rail against the Affordable Care Act, but at the same time, Debbie Stabenow obviously defended the Affordable Care Act, you know, but neither of them really offered any new type of approach to health care and how they would deal with ever-rising cost of healthcare, prescription drugs. There wasn't a lot of specifics on that front. One interesting area they did differ on was when Debbie Stabenow got asked whether she would support Proposal 1, legalization of recreational marijuana. She said she did. She also used it as a way to advertise Proposal 2, the redistricting proposal. And at the same time, John James said he's opposed to this, that he has concerns about workforce safety. He's an employer and he runs a logistics company in Southwest Detroit. And he also wants to see more research into medicinal marijuana. At the same time, he made a kind of a case that he thinks if we're going to legalize marijuana, that we ought to look at criminal justice reform and consider, you know, the impact that we have. If we're going to legalize marijuana for recreational use, we have people sitting in jail because they were dealing or handling marijuana before.
Well, you're in Detroit before the Economic Club. I'm wondering if trade and tariffs came up.
It did. Neither of them offered a solution. You know, John James kind of tried to turn my question about this and say that I don't call it a trade war because I've been to war. I call this a trade negotiation. And so he's an Iraq war veteran, and he thinks that this will all work out eventually, that the U.S. will get a better deal. And he has a front row seat to this issue because his company, James Group International, and one of their subsidiaries, they're the leading export company for Ford Motor Company. That's what they do. They move parts all around the world for Ford to their factories abroad, moving, you know, American-made engines and transmissions. So at the same time, Debbie Stabenow was critical of the president going just too fast in the way he's approached trying to, you know, essentially operate trade wars on multiple fronts with China, with Mexico, and with Canada. She tried to be optimistic that the new U.S.-Mexico-Canadian trade agreement will be good for the automakers, but she wasn't really all that enthusiastic about it.
John James has been trying to paint Stabenow more or less as a left-wing extremist, and Stabenow notes President Trump has been tweeting about James. There's a photo of them together. She's working hard to identify him with Trump. Were those things touched on today in Detroit?
Yeah, President Trump didn't get a lot of airtime today at this event. He wasn't really the focus. Stabenow didn't go after James too much about Trump, and James didn't talk about Trump. He tried to really talk about her record. He uses this refrain over and over. You know, Senator, what took you so long? He talked, you know, she brought up that we just got the money, the $900 million needed to build the new lock at the Sioux Locks. And he said, well, Senator, you've been in office for almost 20 years. What took you so long? So he kept using this, and he did this last night in Grand Rapids as well. It's kind of clearly a rehearsed line that they wanted to use. And they're actually already, Lester, using it in a television ad that they just produced this morning that talks about Debbie Stabenow voting against emergency aid for the Iraq war back in 2007. They use a clip of her in a debate in 2006 saying that she will vote for whatever aid the military needs. And he uses this, from last night's debate in this new TV ad saying, you know, noting that I was there. He was actually on the ground and deployed at the time. So I would expect that you'll see that on your television screens in the coming hours and days.
Yeah, you mentioned that came up because in 2008, Stabenow was working with the Bush and Obama administrations to save GM and Chrysler during the recession. I'm wondering, in light of that, how is she viewed by the Detroit Economic Club members?
Well, she's already got the endorsement of the Detroit Regional Chamber. They endorsed her early back during the primary. Didn't even wait to see how the Republican primary shaked out between John James and businessman Sandy Pensler. So they sort of bucked two of their own members. And you know, she's got the Farm Bureau and she's got a lot of farm support out there because of her work as a ranking member of the Senate Agriculture Committee. But, in the chambers, she seems to have, in the local business community, she seems to have a lot of good connections. I'm not sure if the business community is as in tune with this race as they may be with the governor's race, but partly because this race hasn't gotten a lot of, coverage and she's had 20-point leads in the polls, but, you know, some of those polls are starting to narrow, and, you know, just like regular voters, business leaders are starting to tune in and pay a little more closer attention here in the final weeks of the campaign.
Yeah, I think the latest poll showed her with 9 points ahead. You mentioned the Sioux Locks. I want to touch on one other thing about infrastructure. Did they bring up the topic of roads? Because, you know, federal money for roads is a big deal.
Yeah, they got asked about that. Isn't there an area where they just didn't offer any specifics? Neither of them said, yeah, I'm going to raise the federal gas tax. We'll get more money from Michigan. Nobody was really proposing anything on major significant increases in infrastructure. I mean, Senator Stabenow brought up the president's $1.5 trillion plan that really never materialized. You know, they rolled it out back during one of many infrastructure weeks that the president has had this year. That has gotten no steam. Both of them also kind of talked around a question about the national debt and what they're going to do to lower the national debt at $21 trillion and counting, $1 trillion a year now, even during a very good economy.
Let me shoot a double barrel question at you. First, was there a strong sense among the audience whether there was a debate winner? And number two, will this debate actually have any impact on the race?
Well, it's hard. I don't get a good gauge of how people feel right then and there. There was definitely both sides had good, strong response and claps at different times. So obviously they had some of their own people who paid to get into this debate. Again, and that's another point. This is a debate that was limited to 700 people. It was live streamed on Detroit Public Television, but and there may be some rebroadcast of it. But it's a middle of the day debate. That debate yesterday was at 3 o'clock in the afternoon in a television studio. You know, neither of these debates are going to be on prime time on network television. That's where there's more potential for them to get better exposure. Obviously, I would say that this was a draw for most viewers probably.
Chad Livengood is with Cranes Detroit. He was one of the panelists asking questions of Democrat Debbie Stabenow and Republican John James during a debate between the two U.S. Senate candidates hosted by the Detroit Economic Club. Hey, Chad, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, Lester.
The run-up to this year's midterm elections have been contentious. To better understand the issues that are most important to Michigan voters, we've dispatched reporters and producers throughout the state to ask people two questions. One, what are the most important issues for you as a Michigan voter? And two, what concerns you most about our political climate right now? From now until the election, we'll continue to bring you their answers in a segment called Voter Voices. Today, first we'll hear from Yvonne McKinney at Mac Alter Square on Detroit's east side.
I think it's a good thing to vote. Some people, they got their own opinions, but I feel like this is the time to do something to make the city grow. It don't matter who gets in. I just want them to improve and make this side of Detroit look better, because they're doing a lot of development in certain areas. They need to go inside the neighborhood instead of just on the outskirts where you can see. I want them to be inside of it, tearing down these old abandoned schools and stuff like that so no one can get hurt. I'm not sure about the political people, but I just want the people to be as good as they possibly can.
My name is Elise Graff, and I'm from Wayne, Michigan. The most important issues to me as a Michigan voter are education. I have two young children in school, and they both go to two different schools for different reasons, and education is not exactly what I thought it was until my kids went to school, and I think it's important for teachers to realize that kids all learn differently, and they really need to adapt to how kids learn and not just be, this is how it is in the state and we have to do it this way. My biggest concern about our political climate right now is being a woman in our country right now. Politics can change and trickle all the way down to how our daughters feel, how work treats us, and everything like that. So I think just how women are being listened to and how they feel when they want to speak their own opinion is a big concern.
Special thanks to Imani Mixon and Sarah Leeson for recording those interviews. Coming up, Jeff Jones is the Republican candidate running in Michigan's 12th congressional district. We'll talk with Jones about the issues important to him.
I would say bringing community together and understanding our Constitution as a whole. It's the very thing that unites us. Party politics have divided us long enough.
Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Jaquanda Johnson has been a journalist for years. Most of her career, she's worked in legacy news media outlets, television and newspaper, including the Detroit News and the Flint Journal. Then she went from reporter to entrepreneur. She started an online service called Flint Beat. Jaquanda Johnson joins us now. Hi there.
Hello.
So why leave an established newsroom for a startup journalistic enterprise like Flint Beat?
Because it was a request by the residents. As I covered the city of Flint for MLive Media Group, I talked to residents and I found that they were looking for a news outlet that specifically focused on Flint and that would give them more news. You know, at the time, news was really filled with water crisis, sports, and crime. In a city the size of Flint, we know that there's more news than that. And so the community was looking for something like that. And I'm from Flint. So I'm from this area, born and raised. I'm 42. And I could understand what they were asking for. And I decided to step out there in journalistic faith. And I launched Flint Beat March 2017.
Well, I want to talk about that leap of faith in a little bit. But what kind of stories have you been able to cover that likely wouldn't be picked up by legacy media like the Flint Journal and MLive?
I wouldn't necessarily. I guess I don't want to say that reporters aren't aware. I just know that the shrinking newsroom sometimes prevents them from being able to do certain things. Let's see. Oh, I broke the story about the city councilman pawning his laptop.
No.
I also broke a story when the mayor filed a PPO against the man that was seeking recall against her. So those are two I broke a story about a local pastor allegedly abusing a child. So that's three stories there that I managed to get out before other media.
Why is hyperlocal coverage like Flint Beat important in general and specifically to Flint?
I think that local coverage like Flint Beat is important to empower a community and to inform and to hold government accountable. We as journalists sometimes get caught up in the industry so far as clicks and goals and numbers. But when you are boots on the ground in the community, approaching news from more of a grassroots approach, I think that it helps to impact the community you're covering. Again, hold government accountable in the community you are covering and empower those residents. I think a lot of times we kind of fall back from the reasons we became journalists because we get caught up in all the red tape in the newsroom. I don't have that anymore.
You're not just a journalist anymore. You're now a business person, too. How has that transition gone for you?
Have mercy. I'm just, in all honesty, when I decided to do this, I didn't have support or I didn't quite understand that I would be wearing these multiple hats. I was a journalist, just a writer that wanted to tell stories. So initially, like, I took 6 months just straight reporting at City Hall, at community meetings, just doing my thing as a journalist before I realized, oh, you need money to pay bills. And so then I'm kind of switching hats right now. I'm working as a publisher. I find it to be a necessity, you know, to think about it as a business also, which sometimes for me, it's a battle because at heart, I'm a journalist. And trying to approach this with a business model is a struggle. I've been fortunate enough to be able to find help and support with various organizations out there supporting local news efforts and independent publishing to kind of help me get on the right path to build a sustainable revenue model for Flint Beat.
Yeah, I think a lot of journalists feel if they strike out on their own and serve an underserved population, they'll naturally be supported for it. It doesn't sound like that's the way it works.
It doesn't. That's what I thought. I said, hey, I'll go out here and I'll cover this community and the community and say, oh, she's so great. We love her. And they'll take care of me with this little modest GoFundMe campaign. That did not work.
If you're distracted by a side job plus reporting and trying to find ads and sponsorship for Flint Beat and all that other stuff, when do you have time to report and write?
If you go to my site right now, you'll see I don't write as nearly as much as I used to. I had an intern over the summer that put together a couple pieces, like a food desert piece, and she also produced a video about Flint and the lack of access to fresh fruits and vegetables. But right now, my content isn't nearly where I think it should be.
I was reading in an article that you're also coordinating a program that trains high schoolers to be journalists. How's that play into your overall effort to serve the community?
It's grades 6 through 12. It's called News Movement. It's a youth journalism program. And what happened is after I launched Flint Beat, I started to look for writers in this community. And that was a struggle. There's like a drought. And local publications were pulling from the same little pool of writers, but most of them aren't from Flint. And I decided that there was a need. There was a need to engage children in Flint in journalism, to let them know this is something they could do, and also to diversify newsrooms. So that program launched July 9th.
What's the future look like for Flint Beat?
I feel like I have a chance out there. I feel like I'm filling gaps in news in the Flint area and that I expect to be around for some time.
Jaquanda Johnson is the founder and publisher of Flint Beat. You can find it at flintbeat.com. Hey, best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
As we approach Election Day, November 6th, we're interviewing congressional candidates around the state. Today, we're talking with Republican candidate Jeff Jones. He's running in Michigan's 12th district and challenging incumbent Debbie Dingell. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here. It's an honor to be here.
So you ran for Congress in 2016.
Yes, sir.
So what inspired you or encouraged you to run again?
Well, the job wasn't done. Certainly that we had an amazing gain. We received almost 100,000 votes, just shy of that.
But it's I'll put that into context because that's basically she won by a 2-to-1 margin, right?
You're right, right. So, but our Republicans never received 100,000 votes, and I did so by crossing the line. We estimate about 35% of those votes came from independents and Democrats. So we're pretty happy with those results. But there was more work to be done, and so we're here doing it.
So what's the one of your best assets or experiences that qualifies you to be a member of Congress?
Well, I think really about 30 years of executive upper management and about 35 years of ministry. And to some people, that may not make me a politician. I hope I never really become one, but I'll take the title that comes with it. My role is to uphold the Constitution of the United States and to do so without mental reserve, and that's the issue.
If you're elected, what would be your top priority? I mean, what would be your number one goal to get done?
Well, I think I would really work hard on stopping omnibus bills and going to a one-item legislation at a time. I think that omnibus bills is the perfect plan for lobbyists and politicians to hide how they're invested or the debt they have to pay back. And if we could look at it line by line, it would give us a lot more ability as citizens and to see how it's actually being voted. Because, again, who has time to read 1,500 pages at 7 o'clock in the morning and you got to vote in 2 hours? And that's part of the covering that's been taking place for years. And that's what I hope to do is take the cover off.
You mean because they include a lot of pork?
Yeah.
Which a lot of Congress people like because they can bring something home to the district then.
Well, again, it's still part of the voice of community that gets hidden because, again, it is very lobbyist driven. And I believe that lobbyists steals our voice. You know, I mean, when I ran in 2014 as an independent, someone told me, Jeff, if you had $8 million, you can buy this seat. And I said, excuse me, what do you mean? You spend $8 million, Jeff, and we'll guarantee you that you win the seat. And I said, what? I had no idea that this was part of the play. And since then, that's all I've been experiencing is the influences of money that buys political position versus the causes that are in community that need to be settled.
What is the problem in the 12th district that most needs attention?
I would say bringing community together and understanding our Constitution as a whole. It's the very thing that unites us. Party politics have divided us long enough. Certainly in the community that I live in, there's a great disparity. You know, it's technically a 70-30 split between Democrats and Republicans to the favor of Democrats. The problem is a massive realization this week when I came across an 85-year-old couple in Woodhaven that had lived in their home almost 35 years. It was just random. I just stopped at a house randomly on a road, pulled in, knocked on the door, and they welcomed me. We had great conversation. They're 100% in favor of me. Said, Jeff, boy, you got our vote. This is great. And I said, okay, do you think I could put a sign in your front yard? Oh, Jeff, I'm sorry. You can't do that. And I said, excuse me, why couldn't I? Well, my neighbors are both Democrats, and we'll be bullied and probably harassed, not only when we just take out the trash, but even the concern of our safety under our home and our belongings, because we're bullied in our home, so we can't put signs up to express our First Amendment rights. And I thought that was one of the most saddest things that I've ever heard. And so those are things that have to be addressed in our community.
So how would you address them?
Well, first of all, people got to understand it. I think that when we communicate with community, someone's got to stand up and say insurrection is not the resolve. Resistance, I guess, wasn't working, and so this was the next step to it, to create incivility. You know, and I just don't think that is by I guess it's a crime against humanity that needs to be expressed. So I guess it's got to be an educational factor that we don't have to argue and hate over our the things that we like to stand for or not stand for. So it's I guess ethical resolve you know, again, I could run my entire campaign and love your neighbors yourself, but I don't know if the world's ready for that one yet. But anyway, so yeah, I think it's an education factor.
I was looking over your website, and you frequently mention a tyrannical government. You're a Republican. The president is a Republican. Both chambers of Congress are run by Republicans. The governor's a Republican. Both chambers of the state capitol are run by Republicans. Why do you think government is tyrannical?
Well, I don't think that government is tyrannical, but I do believe it's capable of becoming tyrannical. And certainly as we make those statements about it's about the attack against the Constitution that's been slowly dissolved away and chipped away at for the last 50 to 100 years. So to me, it doesn't matter who's in the White House or what administration is. My obligation is to uphold the oath of Congress, to uphold the Constitution of the United States, and to do so without mental reserve, which means I can't pick and choose the subject matters. I have to speak on behalf of the Constitution and my community. And even if everybody is for you, I should say this, wrong is everything. Wrong is still wrong if everyone is for you, and right is still right if everyone's against you. So these are some of the issues that have to be addressed. So I've never been 100% in agreement with any president. I'm going to have disagreements. But my role is to bring out the best of everybody. That's as a human being is, you know, as certainly in Congress, I think that's how we get to work together is how do we express the understandings versus creating the battle? And you know, party politics have divided us long enough, but we have to find the things that unite us.
You've mentioned that we've been chipping away at the Constitution. I wonder if you'd give me an example or two of what you mean by that.
Okay. Well, I guess certainly personal experience. The 14th Amendment is such a powerful amendment, and it promises life, liberty, and property to all American citizens, right? It's also where we understand the due process law. It's where we get parental rights and grandparent rights. It's also the amendment that challenges forms of immigration. And these are things that little by little have been, I guess, either ignored. I just give you a personal experience. In 2012, my youngest daughter, who was born with Downs at age 4, was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia. I didn't agree with the diagnosis. They had not presented me with an oncologist that could verify that. It was interns at the time. There was no oncologist on staff. And when I started to question the medical world, I found out that the first threat that came to me was, well, you either do what we say or we're gonna take your child away from you. I said, you gotta be kidding me. I want my daughter better. I want my daughter healed. I'm just not in agreement with the diagnosis or the process. Anyways, in a 10-day period of time, my daughter's lymphoblast went from 42% of her blood was not forming. It was blasting apart. With their diagnosis would be leukemia, although there are other blood abnormalities that follow some of these things. I said, well, just give me a number. What number do you need to see? It was 42. I said, what would happen when it turns to zero? They said, Mr. Jones, there's no miracle on the planet that's going to help your child right now to step away from chemotherapy here in Michigan. And so it did go to zero. One little by little, every day it dropped with no chemotherapy. And after 10 days, it finally reached zero. And I thought, we're free. We're going to go home. I mean, my daughter doesn't have cancer in her peripherals, you know, whatever. It wasn't in her bone aspirations either. So anyways, for 2 years, that's when I say all hell broke loose is, you know, we said, okay, look, we're going home. And they said, oh, no, you're not. You know, you're starting chemotherapy today on your 6-year-old daughter, or we're taking your daughter away. And I said, you got to be kidding me. This is absolutely ridiculous. And finding out that my 14th Amendment was being violated and been chewed away in so many different ways through the medical world that no one even saw it happening, I guess. And I didn't see it happen. I didn't know how it was that doctors could tell you what to do, you know, based on how you wanted to care for your child. And this is even part of public education, you know, documentation that we have as parents, that right to do so. So anyways, when that all took place, for 2 years, my daughter was forced into chemotherapy until she died in my arms. And so my daughter for 2 years received chemotherapy for cancer that didn't exist inside of her body. I thought that was very frustrating. And through that, I started to educate myself on the Constitution and the issues that were at hand. I think the Second Amendment's been infringed upon. I think the 10th Amendment, the enumerated powers of Congress have been expanded and go and operate outside of those issues. I think the First Amendment is ignored and violated in so many areas and under attack, actually, in certain areas over the last 20, 30 years. And so these were the things that I started noticing that, oh, my goodness, and then trying to relate those to some sort of of how and why and you know, and then understanding the positioning of some of those tremendous Bill of Rights and how they were placed or why they were placed. And we forget about the Third Amendment. And even though, you know, very rarely do we see government, you know, taking over your house and stealing your chickens, your horse, and maybe your children and burning your house down. But that's what happened in the country at the time it was written. So it said, you know what, when they finally sat down and wrote that Constitution, they said, we're never, ever, ever, ever going to let this happen again in the United States. So they placed the Second Amendment in front of the Third Amendment that said, no, you can't quarter, you know, you can't take over civilian housing and so forth. And the Second Amendment has a powerful play. Not that everybody's waiting to draw their guns, that's ridiculous. But responsible gun ownership and the opportunity to protect your family or to protect your community, or God help us, if we have leadership now that embraces the philosophies of Antifa and says that, oh my goodness, you can, you know, if you can't resist, you can go ahead and riot. I call that insurrection. And I would say that anybody who took an oath of office and anybody who runs for an office that supports it has violated even more constitutional amendments that we don't even realize. So, yeah, it's been chipped away at.
And this is the primary reason you're running for Congress?
I would say it's the primary reason I'm running, yeah, that someone needs to stand. So I think the Constitution unites us as a community rather than divide us like party politics has. I'm not a party politician. I don't look around my community and say, oh, there's a Democrat, there's a Republican, oh, there's this faction, there's that faction, or this person who, and I don't care if they're 0.5% of the population, they live in my community, and my obligation is to hear them, listen to them, and find resolve for us in community. And so, yeah, that's my why, that's my reasoning, and that's my purpose for living.
Jeff Jones is the Republican candidate to represent Michigan's 12th Congressional District. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Tomorrow, we'll talk to incumbent Debbie Dingell. This is Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. There's been a decades-long real-life drama taking place on a remote island in Lake Superior. Isle Royale has been home to prey and predator, subjects of one of the longest-running research projects in the world. Moose and wolf populations have been up and down on the island, but in recent years, the wolf population dropped to just 2. The National Park Service debated what to do. Let the wolves die off or add some new lifeblood into the line of wolves? Joining me to talk about that is John Vucetich. He's a professor of wildlife ecology at Michigan Technological University, and he heads up the Wolves and Moose of Isle Royale Research Project. So let's deal with some basics. How big is Isle Royale?
Oh, well, let's see. Isle Royale is about 210 square miles, and that also means that it's about roughly 50 miles long and about 10 or 8 miles wide. So it's a long, skinny island.
How did moose and wolves end up on that island?
Well, in historic times, which don't go back that far, only 1850s or so, in historic times, what we know about is that, well, there were neither wolves nor wolves in the early 19th century. Moose got there right around the turn of the century, not entirely known how they got there, but likely they swam. And then they were on the island, the moose were, for about 50 years all by themselves, really just meaning in the absence of wolves. And then in about the year 1950, wolves show up, and they got there by crossing an ice bridge.
Yeah, that's a long swim for the moose. Over the many years of the wolf and moose interaction, there have been a lot of changes, fluctuation in the populations. What can you sum up for us about that?
As you mentioned, the fluctuations have been pronounced over the past 5 or 6 decades, and that's normal and to be expected and even celebrated in a lot of ways. But what happened in the most recent decade is that ice bridges became far less frequent, and that meant the possibility for an immigrant wolf to come to Isle Royale really quite diminished. That led to a great deal of inbreeding on behalf of the Isle Royale wolves. They suffered from that inbreeding right to the point of going down to, as you had mentioned in the intro, just 2 wolves. And that turns out to have been too few wolves for predation as a process. So those 2 wolves were doing fine in terms of their ability to get food. But 2 wolves don't have to take down a moose very often. And so that meant that predation no longer was an important force in the population dynamics of that moose population. And that's where the concerns arose.
Can you tell me about what having too many moose might mean for the environment?
You know, one of the most important things is that moose would be at risk of undercutting their own food supply. So moose eat quite a few different plants in the forest. And, you know, if there's not too many moose, that's just fine. But if the moose number gets to be too abundant, or if they rise to high levels too frequently, they can cause damage to some of the species of trees, damage that's not easily undone. And then the trees don't grow back quite as well. And then there can't be as many moose on the island. And one of the things that can happen subsequently from that is if there aren't enough moose on the island, it precludes the possibility of there having enough wolves on the island. Because, of course, the moose have to be in adequate numbers for there to be a wolf population. The reason why that's all important is that most scientists have an understanding that a healthy ecosystem is one where you has large ungulates and large predators. That's an important part of, especially a place like Isle Royale.
It took a while to determine whether to repopulate the wolves at all. What were the concerns?
Right. There were two major concerns, and they both stem from an issue that goes well beyond Isle Royale. And the issue is, what is the purpose of a protected area, or what is the purpose of our national parks? And there become two answers to that question. One is that these protected areas are healthy to the degree that humans haven't interfered with them. And the other is that they're healthy if they have all of the important parts. And in this case, the important parts end up being wolves. And to, you know, refer to that first possibility, that a place is healthy to the extent that humans haven't intervened, the concerns end up being things like, well, climate change was a human-caused factor, and that's what led to wolves not doing so well. And some people would say, yeah, that's right, and so we could mitigate that by putting wolves back there. And the rejoinder to that is, oh my gosh, only a person who is really addicted to human intervention would think that the solution to human intervention was yet again more human intervention. Anyways, the one side of the story goes something like that. The other side of the story is, if it takes human intervention to make sure that all the important parts of an ecosystem are present, well, that may not be the best scenario, but it might still be a necessary thing to do, better than letting some of these parts be lost.
I can understand all of that, but at the same time, we have state agencies and federal agencies that, you know, only exist to manage wildlife. I'm just surprised that there was that much debate about whether to repopulate the wolf population.
Right. I think what makes the debate, and without trying to defend the view, but just to kind of explain why it was important in this case and why it took on the flavor that it took, is that Isle Royale is a federally designated wilderness, and these are some of the places, and they really account for a very small part of the United States, where we, generally speaking, are most proud about them being least impacted. And so I think for some folks, it's not as though there's a concern with intervening with nature from time to time or from place to place, but that there might not be some places where we don't do it.
Right.
And again, for emphasis, it's not a view that I subscribe to, but just to try to explain the view of those who do hold that view.
In the end, the National Park Service decided to go ahead and bring wolves to Isle Royale. Officials say they'll relocate up to 30 wolves to the island in the next 3 to 5 years. So far, they've brought 3 female wolves and 1 male wolf from Minnesota to Isle Royale. How is capturing and relocating the wolves going so far?
There's some criteria for which wolves can make it to the island. For example, they don't want to bring wolves that are too young, just to name one example. So they've caught some wolves, and some of these wolves haven't met the criteria, so they've been quickly released back into the wild, and you know they've continued with the rest of their lives. There was really quite unfortunately and sadly, one wolf was captured and then subsequently died. That's not a particularly common outcome, but it does happen. When people decide to handle animals, wild animals, one has to accept the risk that something bad like that can happen. And if that risk is simply deemed unacceptable, you know, a person shouldn't be engaged in that in the first place. And so I think the park was quite conscious of the risk and believed that they were, you know, making good decisions to go ahead, even though there is that risk.
So when these wolves are taken out of a place they know and put on an island that they don't know, what kind of stressors are there?
Well, in this particular case, I kind of think that going to Isle Royale is probably mostly an easing of stressors, because there's no risk of being killed by humans, which is an extremely important cause of death for wolves. There's no cars that are going to run you over, and there's no poaching, no hunting, no trapping. And so that's a pretty big stress in the life of a wolf, and that's all been pretty quickly removed. The next thing that's really difficult is being in a place where there's enough prey, and at the moment there's lots of prey on Isle Royale, and so that part is all right. The other important stress in the life of a wolf is competition with other wolves. And in this case, there's so few wolves on Isle Royale that one wouldn't expect that they're being placed in any sort of like undue sort of competition scenario. They've got the same or possibly less competition stress than if they were on the mainland.
So with this repopulation of wolves, what's your prognosis for the wolf and moose population on Isle Royale, say, for the next decade?
Well, first off, for the next couple of years, I think we'll still continue to see the moose population increase. But there's a very good chance it'll only take a couple of years before the wolf population is back on its feet, so to speak. That should cause the moose population to come back down. I think the big question, the one that we can't answer now, we can only wait and see, is whether the moose population declines before they do long-term damage to the forest. And that's just something that will take time to wait and see.
Now, I want to talk about your research a little bit because it's interesting. When you're there, I assume you do some aerial surveys, but when you're on the ground there in the winter, what are you doing?
Oh, a variety of things. For example, we're following the wolves every day that we're able to, looking in particular for instances where they've killed a moose. And when the wolves are done feeding on that moose, and that might take anywhere from 1 or 2 or 3 or 5 days, when they're done feeding on that moose and then they leave, one of our interests is to land the plane on the nearest frozen lake, strap on our snowshoes, hike in, and we want to perform a necropsy on that moose. We want to know, is that a moose that, had the wolves not killed it, it would have gone on living, or is it a moose that was about to die anyways? Being able to answer a question like that helps us understand whether wolves are having a big impact on the moose population or not such a big impact.
So as you continue your research, what are you going to be watching for?
Well, I think the most important thing to know is that the way that we've been successful up until now in our research has been to be very good observers, and then nature usually tells us what the great stories are. You know, the important things that have happened in the past have included unexpected severe winters, unexpected introduction of diseases, unexpected genetic events like the immigrant of a wolf that came in the late 1980s. These are all changes that one never could have predicted or anticipated, but we were there in place watching, and when they occurred, we were able to learn interesting things about it. It's not the most common way to describe how science ought to work, but it's been pretty successful for us to just watch and see, and I have a feeling we won't be disappointed if we maintain that kind of modus operandi.
John Vucetic heads up the Wolves and Moose of Isle Royale Research Project. Thanks for the update.
It was great to be here. Thanks so much.
My mother was a gardener. She had picked cotton in the South. And every spring when she began her garden there in Grand Rapids, you know, Michigan has that rich black dirt, great rich black dirt. And as the winter started to give way, right before it started to get actually really warm, but warm enough so that the ground was softer, my mom would go out and take all the weeds out of her garden. Have us do that, take all the weeds out, and then as a proper gardener would do, she would wet her dirt, you know, of top to bottom, and then she'd work the soil to make sure it's all nice and soft. And when she got her garden ready, she would tell me, "Willie, come on out here in the dirt with me." And I'd go out into the dirt with her, and she'd say, Stick your hands down the dirt." And she'd make me stick my hands into the dirt down to my elbows. That's how soft she had gotten it, down to my elbows. And she'd have her elbows almost up to her shoulder, up to the almost to the end of her shoulders in that dirt. And she would turn to me and say, "You feel that? You feel that, son? That's life. That's life."
We are of the dirt. That's what Willie Jennings believes. He grew up on the southeast side of Grand Rapids. Now he's a scholar at Yale Divinity School. And he says dirt is important to the understanding of each other as people because dirt is what joins us in the first place. We may have differences, but we have the land in common. And what do we learn about ourselves when we look at our land? Well, that's a question our reporter Dustin Dwyer has been thinking about a lot. This week, he brings what he found. We're calling this An Idea on the Land, a story in 4 parts. Part 1, Look About You.
You know that saying we have in Michigan, if you seek a pleasant peninsula, look about you? Forget about what you're seeking for a minute. Just wherever you are, look about you. If you're in a building, look at the walls. If there's a window, you can look out the window, look at the trees, the grass, the parking lot, the land. Just about everywhere in Michigan, even out in nature, you can see how humans have changed things. You can see our ideas inscribed on the land. The most noticeable one is our idea about property. We hardly even think about property. It just is. Sure, a person can own a piece of the earth. Just imagine a line. Imagine a rectangle sitting there. Everything inside that rectangle is yours. Take that dirt. Do whatever you want. It's yours. But that idea came from somewhere. It has a history. All the ideas we live with about our land, they came from somewhere. And a lot of them haven't even been here that long.
If you were here in 1817, Michigan would have seemed an entirely indigenous space. It was dominated by Native peoples who lived in Detroit, Mackinac, in the Grand River Valley, in the Upper Peninsula. And anywhere you went, you would have encountered Native people, and it would have been Native people who are continuing to living as their ancestors had done.
Michael Witkin is a historian. He's a member of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, and he's written about the history of Native people in the Great Lakes in the time after Europeans arrived. A lot's happened in that period, but some people missed it in history class.
The biggest thing that they miss is that we're still here, that there's still a significant Native population in the state of Michigan. There are 14 reservations, 14 communities. So that's the biggest thing.
But not the only thing they miss.
The next biggest thing is a kind of misconception that when the territory that's now Michigan gets claimed by New France, that it's suddenly actually a part of New France, that it's dominated and controlled by Europeans, when in fact, really, it's still entirely a Native space.
There just weren't that many Europeans for hundreds of years. They had little villages in Detroit, in Fort Mackinac, in Sault Ste. Marie, not much else. They saw the rest of the land of Michigan as unsettled wilderness. Unsettled even though there were thousands of people on it, people with political systems, economic systems, agricultural systems.
But from a European standpoint, because it's not been carved up into individual farms that are fenced and have built structures, for them, that means it's a wilderness.
A wilderness to be taken and tamed. And we all know that this happened. The Europeans came in, they did what they did. But why did they see the land that way? And why did they see Native people that way? The ideas came from somewhere. Willie Jennings says a big part of those ideas came from the Europeans' distorted understanding of the Bible.
They came believing that they were the people of God, having replaced Israel as the people of God. And so that God's hopes for the world rested on them.
Them. It was also important who they believed they were and who other people were not. They were the white people. And that combination, Christianity plus whiteness, shaped the new world, Jennings says. He's studied and written about this history a lot. He wrote a book called The Christian Imagination, Theology and the Origins of Race. And Jennings says whiteness should not be thought of as a person or as a group of people. No one is born white, he says. It's an idea, a way of being in the world. And at first, it was a harmless way for the Europeans to designate people in a land where not everyone looked the same.
And what began as really harmless designation soon took on a world of harm as they did one crucial thing with their life in the New World. They seized land.
And why did they seize it? Because they believed it was already theirs as white people, the chosen people of God.
And so they helped to create a new vision of the world as not only a possession given by God, but as infinitely possessible, i.e., individual, private ownership of the world itself.
Private ownership of land. That idea we don't always think about, but that shapes our entire experience of the land. Jennings says it even shaped the history of why so many Europeans came to the Americas. Because here it was possible for common people to be landowners, not just tenants of the aristocracy. That hope of ownership is what brought many Europeans to the shores of the New World. And you can see why it would be so tempting.
You know, imagine coming to Michigan. You're staring out at the majesty of Lake Superior. And the beauty of the trees and the fruit and the animals. And of course, there are people. and someone whispers to you, all this is yours. All this is yours.
That was from our reporter, Dustin Dwyer. Tomorrow, the series continues with the story of the Supreme Court case that set the precedent for indigenous property rights in the U.S., the case of Johnson versus McIntosh, tomorrow on our series, An Idea on the Land. Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Mike Blank. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.